right, let's just get started. Then we'll talk about the other information later. Okay, so we're up to Yosef HaTzadik part 4. So we last left off with Yosef having significantly begun to grow in terms of his ability to be there for other people, to be sensitive to the needs of those who are around him, to believe specifically that Hashem is there with him in his life, that how he has grown from being with his brothers to not being able to empathize at all, seemingly, to really being able to care for others and to trust and know that Hashem is with him and the reason for all of the success that he has in his life. We are now up to the what I'll call the final chapter of his life, although it's obviously nowhere near done, and that is the chapter in which he finally meets Paro, and when he becomes second to the king. This is his last major shift in his life. He'll be in this position until the end of his life, and obviously with lots of more ups and downs as become the paradigm of his life, but this is the last real major transition that he has to go through in terms of his own life movement. So we're going to pick up and just focus on chapter 41, Perek Mem Aleph of his life today, and that's really just the chapter in which he meets Paro, but a lot of other things happen in it. Not only does he meet Paro, he interprets the dreams of Paro, but way beyond that, he also becomes second to the king, and he also gets married, and he gets a new name, and he starts a family. So lots happened in this in chapter 41. Perek Mem Aleph. So let's just jump right in. So we're source number one, Perek Mem Aleph, Psukim Tes through Yudalid. So you'll note that these Psukim, we briefly brought them up last week, but this is really where our story picks up. So let's take a look inside. Source number one. The chief cupbearer then spoke up and said to Paro, I must make mention today of my offenses. Once Paro was angry with his servants and placed me in custody in the house of the chief steward, together with the chief baker. We had dreams the same night, he and I, each of us a dream with a meaning of its own. A Hebrew youth was there with us, a servant of the chief steward, and when we told him our dreams, he interpreted them for us, telling each of the meaning of his dream. And as he interpreted for us, so it came to pass, and I was restored to my post, and the other was impaled. Thereupon Paro sent for Yosef, and he was rushed from the dungeon, from the pit. He had his hair cut, and he changed his clothes, and he appeared before Paro. Or, the translation is not so good. It's not really that he appeared, but that he came before Paro. And so we experience two pieces of imagery over here. Number one, that he's being taken out of the pit, that he's finally removed from that pit that he was thrown in so many years ago that led to all the trials and tribulations of his life thus far. But now he's finally removed from the pit that his brothers threw him in, and he gets onto the world stage, as it were. And after that, after he's taken out of the pit, he's cleaned up, because he really does, as we know, care about his appearances, but it seems like he is not the one making sure that he looks nice. It's those who are around him, the servants, if you will, who are now making sure that he looks nice. So the first question we'll have to wonder is, why was it that he was rushed, right? The pasuk says, "Vayari tsuhu min habor." He was rushed out of the pit. Why was he rushed out? What's the significance of being rushed out so quickly? So the probably simplest answer, as someone suggested in Shul, is just that he was, Paro was anxious to hear his interpretation of his dream. So he said, if you have someone, bring him out, rush him out. That's probably the simplest way to understand it. And that's probably what the Radak meant in source number 3, that Hotzi because whenever the king says something, we get really right to it. We have to make sure to follow the word of the king, right? The President Biden tells us to do something, you do it. That's just how it works. And so that's how we are to understand that. However, the Sforno seems to understand it much more differently, and with a slight beautiful understanding. And then he says as follows, source number 2, that a miraculous deliverance always transpires with haste, right? The famous idea that kol Yeshua's keharif ayin, that all salvation comes like a blink of an eye. So and so it was when the Israelites left Egypt, and so it will be when Yisrael is redeemed from the current exile. When we leave exile, even though it might take a long time to get to the redemption, once we get there, terrifying. We get out like a snap, and that's what's demonstrated in the fact that Yosef was rushed out so quickly. The point that Hashem has finally been working with Yosef on for so long, he is now ready to fulfill his destiny, and that he's becoming second to the king to take up the mantle of leadership that he knew he was going, that he was meant to take even as just a young man. What's interesting to note is what the significance of the change in appearances that he takes now is, as opposed to how we saw him earlier, right? Of course, we know earlier when he was in the house of Potiphar, he was working on his hair, and he was, I don't know, getting a manicure, whatever he was doing, which was very inappropriate, as Rashi explains, that it was such a terrible thing that he was doing, that he was focusing on his appearances, and Yaakov, his father, was mourning, and that's when Rashi quoted the Medrash that said that he was going to stick the bear on him, and that's when Ishus Potiphar went after him. And what's interesting over here is that does not seem to be the same connotation with him preparing his appearances. Because Rashi says in source number 4, why is Yosef getting ready? V'pnei kavod ha-malchus. Now he actually has something really significant to look beautiful for, not for to look nice in the mirror, not because he wants to feel good about himself, but because of kavod ha-malchus, that he wants to honor the king. And if he wants to honor the king, now that's something appropriate for him to be getting ready for. However, the Das is a Canaan in source number 5 seem to take a slightly different approach. Not that he's getting ready for the king, as in Paro, but rather for a different king. Mikan remez lamash amru razal b'Rosh Hashanah yatsa Yosef mibeis asurim. Yosef came out of prison when? On Rosh Hashanah. Which means he was getting dressed up, making himself look nice. Why? Not for Paro the king, but for the king of kings. This is a clear move and step of Yosef in terms of honoring and wanting to recognize the greatness of the creator of the universe, the creator of everything. And so you can look at it two different ways, right? Maybe this just shows how he was a respectful individual. He knew how one should dress in front of royalty, or it's that he knew exactly how an Eved Hashem should dress, how someone who serves God should dress, and that's why he got dressed up so nicely and he made his appearance all nice, because it was Rosh Hashanah, the day of the coronation of the King of Kings. Now, the last thing we'll note in these several psukim that we quoted is how the pasuk refers to Yosef getting closer to Paro. It says, Vayavo el Paro, that he comes to Paro. If you take a look at source number 6, we see that Yosef does this in a previous incident, but not with Paro, actually with his father. Eile todos Yaakov Yosef ben Shiva Esrei Shana haya ro'eh sachav betzon, v'hu na'ar espenei bilav espenei zilpa. Right, we quoted this pasuk many times before. Vayavo Yosef Esdiba Samra'a Elavihem. Yosef came to who? He came to his father. Clear distinction over here in terms of how Yosef, or rather, not a distinction at all, but rather the character distinction with the same attribute, with the same actions. He comes to his father, and he also comes to Paro as well. What is he coming to, or what is the meaning behind this coming to these individuals? Well, it would seem to represent some sort of an eagerness to serve. He loved to serve his father, and now he's going to learn to love to serve Paro, and clearly the text wants us to link these two stories together. Whether it's the fact, as Rabbi Foreman explains, and we'll talk about a little bit later as well, and as we go on in the weeks to come, that Paro in many ways takes on a father role in the life of Yosef, but perhaps there's also, just removing that entirely from the picture, maybe we're meant to view this as that Vayava Yosef es diba samra'ai was specifically the evil words that Yosef spoke about his brothers, that he brought to his father, and it was that whole beginning where enabled his brothers to become jealous and to not like him, and therefore as a result he was sold into slavery. That was the very beginning. That was the first Vayavo, where Yosef came to his father, and it all started from there, and now he's Vayavo Paro, because this is the end of the line. This is the culmination of that first act that he made, talking badly about his brothers so many years before. As we go now into part 2 of this parak, we go into the interpretation of the dream segment. We're not going to read it inside in source number 7, because I quoted a lot of psukim over here. It's Paro telling over the dream and Yosef interpreting the dream. But you'll take note of a few different things that I tried to highlight for you on the source sheet, and that is, number one, we'll first take a look at the underline over here, where it says, not I, God will see to Paro's welfare. And again, we see Yosef clearly attributing all of his success and all of his knowledge not to himself, but to Paro. This seems to be an even stronger statement than he had made previously when he was in prison, when he said, no, God's going to interpret your dream. Now it's, I am nothing, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I'm like the dust of the world, and God's going to be the one to interpret everything for you, Paro, which is some sweeping statement. It's one thing to tell your fellow inmate that God's going to help you. It's another thing to look at the leader of the free world and tell him, this guy who you never heard of, I call him God, he's going to be the one to help. That's a major statement for Yosef to have made, and it's clear about how he places, where he places the importance of Hashem in your life in this situation over here. The other thing that you'll note is I named every incident in which we have the name of Paro, and every incidence in which we have the name of Hashem. And you'll note that both Paro's name and God's name come up an awful lot. And the obvious question is, why do God and Paro's name come up a lot? So you'll tell me, well, we know why God comes up a lot, because now we're trying to show how Yosef is loyal to Hashem, and he believes in Hashem, and he trusts that Hashem is guiding him. But maybe also what the Torah is trying to tell us is that there was some sort of an inner conflict between Yosef at this point and in the months and the years to come in his life. Because not only does he have a clear allegiance and belief in Hashem that he's the one who's supporting him and helping him and guiding him, but beyond that, Paro becomes the major figure in his life in terms of caring for him and in terms of making sure that everything is going well in his life. So Yosef, on the one hand, clearly has a connection to Hashem and he wants to serve Hashem, but Paro becomes so significant in his life, and so maybe Yosef will experience this inner tension between who is, it's hard to phrase it like this, but kevayachol, who is more important, who it takes more of a more significant role in his life. Where does his allegiance lie? Is it with Egypt, with Paro, or is it with God and his family? We've always been taught the latter, that Yosef has a clear allegiance to only Hashem and to the Abrahamic traditions, to his father's family, but maybe he did have some inner tensions. Again, impossible to ever know, but perhaps you can argue that there is something there. The part three of the story now in source number 8 is when Yosef finally makes it to the rise in the second in command. Take a look at what the Pesukim have to say. And Paro said to his courtiers, could we find another like him? A man in whom is the spirit of God. So Paro said to Yosef, since God has made all this known to you, there is none so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my court, and by your command shall all my people be directed. Only with respect to the throne shall I be superior to you. Paro further said to Yosef, see, I put you in charge of all the land of Egypt. And removing his signet ring from his hand, Paro put it on Yosef's hand, and he had him dressed in robes of fine linen, and put a gold chain about around his neck. He had him ride in the chariot of his second in command, and they cried before him, Avreich! Thus he placed him over all of the land of Egypt, and Paro said to Yosef, I am Paro, yet without you, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Goes without saying the parallels between this specific grouping of Pesukim and the Megillah Esther story. It's clear with the signet ring and the fancy clothes. Clearly this is meant to be an Achashverosh Mordechai parallel to Paro and Yosef over here. But we're not going to go too much more into that right now, but the textual similarity is so evident. The big question we have to wonder is, why did Paro like Yosef so much? You don't really stop to think about it often enough, but here you have, again, the leader of the free world. He just met some guy in prison. He gave him what he wanted. He gave him the interpretation of his dream. Why, he like falls in love with this guy. He literally makes him second in command. He literally gives him the kingdom. What is going on? Why does he care so deeply for Yosef? So there are really two perspectives over here I think you could take. One perspective is, as we can find alluded to in source number 9 in the Bereishis Rabbah, in the Medrash, it says as follows, Rabbi Yeshua, in the name of Rabbi Levi, they interpreted it for him, but their interpretation failed to convince him. Meaning that there are other people, as we know very famously, would line up, right? Much like there were many people lined up to become the queen of Shushan, so too we also have people lining up to interpret the dream of Paro. So many people lined up and they gave Paro different interpretations. For example, the 7 goodly cows signify 7 daughters that you will father, the 7 evil-looking ones that you will bury, 7 daughters, the 7 goodly ears, 7 provinces you will conquer, the 7 withered ears that 7 provinces will rebel against you. So whatever it is, different interpretations, none of them made any sense to Paro. They did not click. Why did they click? Why did it click finally when Yosef gave his interpretation? Because of the fact that Paro dreamed also the interpretation of his dream. He dreamed the interpretation, but he forgot it. Once he was reminded, when Yosef told him the true interpretation, he then knew, this guy knows what he's talking about. In other words, what I would argue is that the one perspective is to say that Paro brought him close to making the second in command. He developed a feelings and a relationship with him because he said, this guy is great. This guy is a highly talented individual, and I want him in my court. I want him to be close to me because I can really benefit and grow a lot from this guy. That would, in theory, require a very self-aware and selfless Paro, which again is kind of hard to believe because you don't normally think of these evil kings. I'm not saying that Paro is necessarily evil, but in general, you know, you don't really find the Pharaoh throughout Tanakh to be such a loving and merciful person. And so the fact that he would have just developed such a beautiful relationship with Yosef, it's hard to believe, although it could be, and that seems to be one perspective. The alternative perspective, I would say, is that we know that you keep your friends close and you keep your enemies closer. Yosef is a big threat to the monarchy of Paro. If anyone is going to be able to defeat Paro, it'll be the guy that not only knows what's going to happen, but knows the solution to stop it. I don't care how powerful Paro's kingdom is. If Yosef opens up shop and he says he's the guy standing on the street corner with the flyer saying the end of the world is coming, famine is coming, but here's what you gotta do, you just gotta accept. He has the solution to all of life's issues, then Paro's gonna be pretty stupid if he wouldn't have accepted him to come in his house so that he can basically take all the credit for what Yosef does. And that's essentially what happens. He says, Yosef, I'm really the king, but you are really in charge. Yeah, that's a, it's like a trick almost. It's him saying you can do whatever you want, but let's get one thing straight over here. I'm still the king at the end of the day, but you make all the decisions because you're clearly smarter than me. So he's keeping his friends close, but his enemies even closer. We also do, of course, continue to see the father-son parallels in the fourth part of this perek. In Pasuk Meme, Pasuk 45, source number 10, Vayikra Paro Shem Yosef Tzafnas Paneach Vayiten Lo Es Asnas Bas Potifera Kohen On Liisha Vayitze Yosef Al Eretz Mitzrayim. So Yosef is given a new name by Paro. Again, who gives a new name? Rabbi Foreman loves he really, this is like the number one Pasuk for Rabbi Foreman, for his theory of the father-son relationship between Yosef and Paro, because of the fact that who gives someone a name, and who gives someone a wife, and who helps someone find a job, usually that's what a father does for a son. And it's clear on some level that that's what Paro is doing for Yosef. He gave him a job, he gave him a new name, Tzafnas Paneach, which literally means like interpreter of dreams, or like the revealer of the hidden, and so that's his new name. And he gets a wife. Who is the wife? It's a little unclear who this woman is. Who is Asnas Bas Potifera? So the real question is, if you want to know who Asnas is, you have to know who Potifera is. So the traditional perspective of the offered by Rashi, Potifera is Potiphar. This would even show us a stronger connection between Yosef and Potiphar, right? Remember, think way back. So Yosef had seemingly a pretty rough falling out with Potiphar when his wife claimed that he tried to be intimate with her. But then we said maybe that wasn't as much of a falling out as we had always thought it was, because of the fact that the head of the prison also seemed to be Potiphar, and he took care of Yosef, so perhaps they did have a strong relationship. And so now what's going to be? Evidently, Yosef ends up marrying Potiphar's daughter, because again, the relationship that they had was very strong, probably had an awkward relationship with the mother-in-law, but otherwise this woman seemed to be from the household of Potiphar. However, there is an alternative perspective, probably because of the fact that it's so interesting that Yosef would be marrying an Egyptian woman. We don't normally look so highly on marrying Egyptian women. I wouldn't put them in the same category as a Canaanite woman, right? We know that Shimon and Yehuda both potentially got into trouble, as we said, that they married Canaanite women. Maybe. Some people say yes. Some people say no. Maybe it's okay. Maybe the issue of marrying a Canaanite woman only applied to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and not to the sons. But nonetheless, there were those who took issue with it. Yosef marrying an Egyptian woman is an interesting move, and maybe not blatantly prohibited, but certainly not something that you would expect of someone, as we call Yosef, a tzaddik. And therefore, there is another perspective, and that is that he didn't marry the daughter of Potiphar, but rather he married another woman. Who is that? Dina Bas, Asnas Bas Dina, the daughter of Dina and Shechem. Shechem and Dina, as we know, had a child. We know that Shimon raised this child, or at least according to one interpretation. And Yosef then ends up marrying her. If Shimon was the one who did raise this young woman, Asnas, who marries Yosef, then you have to really try to wrap your head around the fact that Yosef ends up putting Shimon in prison later, that he's the one. There's a lot of family politics here that you have to really try to understand. And in particular, the biggest question is, if this really is the daughter of Dina and Shechem, what is she doing here? A, what is she doing here? B, how come no one told Yaakov what was going on? Literally. So we'll talk about Yosef in a second, why he never wrote home. But what, Asnas, whose grandfather was Yaakov, she didn't say, hey, Zeta, by the way, I married your son who you thought died? What's going on over here? So there is a picture that you could paint. This is total conjecture and total theoretical information, because I don't know if this is true, but maybe you can paint a picture. Why would it make sense for Yosef to have married this woman? Well, you could imagine Asnas, if she is the daughter of Shechem and Dina, she probably was not fully accepted into the family. After all, being the daughter of Shechem, this evil prince that none of the family liked, that the whole family wanted to kill, that Shimon and Levi did kill, it's not a very good way to start off a childhood. And not only that, you would imagine that the as a result of all of that, the siblings might not have treated her well, maybe the cousins might not have treated her well, and the fact that Shimon, if he did take care of her, she probably was a little bit pushed out because Shimon wasn't really were so well liked or well respected by the rest of the family, and therefore as a result you have a girl here who was a shtickle bit of an outlaw in the family, and maybe she felt like she wanted to run away. Maybe she did run away. Maybe she found herself in Egypt, and maybe she felt disconnected from the family. And what do you know? When she found herself in Egypt, she met this guy Yosef, who she thought died, but turns out he didn't die. He was actually killed by her father, the one who raised her. And so as a result of that, we could understand, we can really, again, it's total conjecture and total theory, but you can really paint an interesting picture here of how it would make sense that she, that if this was the daughter of Dinah and Shechem, why she never would have written home. But anyways, those are the two possibilities. Either she was the daughter of Potiphar, or she was the daughter of Dinah and Shechem. Finally, we have source number 11, part 5 of the story. Yosef builds his life and his family, and Yosef starts this new era in his life, which will be the majority of the years of his life, in which he is able to not only take care of his family and not only become the leader of Egypt, but become the leader of the free world in which he had dreamed about at a very young age. Take a look at source number 11. Yosef was 30 years old when he entered the service of Paro, king of Egypt. Leaving Paro's presence, Yosef traveled through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 years of plenty, the land produced in abundance, and he gathered all the grain of the 7 years that the land of Egypt was enjoying, and okay, etc., etc. Skip a few psukim. Before the years of famine came, Yosef became the father of two sons, whom Asnas, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Yosef named the first son Manasseh, meaning God has made me forget completely my hardship and my parental home, and the second he named Ephraim, meaning God has made me fertile in the land of my affliction. So in other words, there's like these two separations now between Yosef and his family's history. He, number one, has one son Manasseh, who was the comfort that he had so deeply needed to help him get over all of the distress that he had of this family that once was, and then he had Ephraim, who was the representation of not only is he getting over it, but now he's flourishing in this new land. And it's clear that these two children represent his ability, his desire to move on from what was in his life, the distressing previous years that he had until now. And of course, the major question that everyone wants to come down to is, why is it that Yosef never contacted his father after he got into power? Right? We understand why when he was in prison, and even why he was in the house of Potiphar, why he never would have contacted his father. He didn't have the power or the ability to, but now he's the second most powerful person on the face of the earth. He can find a way to send a messenger and say, hey, by the way, daddy, I'm here and I'm alive. And so there's a lot of suggestions and questions and understandings of what took place over here, but I want to share one with you, and that is from Rav Yoel ben Nun. Take a look at source number 12. It's actually a very long article written by Rabbi Yitzchak at Shalom, who's in LA, and he's a big Tanakh expert, and so he writes out basically almost like a summary of an essay of an argument between Rav Meidan and Rav Yoel ben Nun, but we'll only share Rav Yoel ben Nun's opinion. Take a look at source number 12, about four paragraphs down, where it says, one, Rav Yoel ben Nun's solution. So this, we'll read a little bit, we're not going to do it all, but we'll read a little bit. He says as follows, the usual solution advanced by the Ramban, that Yosef was trying to fulfill the dreams, is rejected by Rav ben Nun, chiefly because it doesn't address, in his opinion, the moral question. How could Yosef have left his father in torment, only to bring his dreams to fruition? In other words, the Ramban suggests that Yosef didn't ever write back home because of the fact that he was he understood that this was God's plan, and God's plan was clearly that Yaakov wouldn't know what had happened, and so therefore he let it be. It's a very difficult thing to say. It's still the Ramban, so you can't just throw it out, but how do you make such a claim that he was so deeply committed to this theoretical understanding of what God had wanted? How did Yosef know exactly? So there's a lot of difficulty with it, but nonetheless, it is the Ramban, so we don't throw it out entirely, but Rav Ben Nun takes some difficulty with it, and so he says further, our entire outlook on the story changes, however, if we accept the fact that Yosef did not know that his brothers had fooled his father with the coat, the blood, and the lie that Yosef had been devoured by wild animals. Such thoughts never occurred to him. Hence, it was Yosef who spent 13 years of slavery in Egypt and the following years of greatness wondering, where is my father? Why has no one come to look for me? All the factors are now reversed when seen from Yosef's point of view. Egypt is, after all, close to Canaan, and Yaakov was a rich, important, and influential man with the international, familial, and political connections. The Midianites or the Ishmaelites who brought Yosef to Egypt were his cousins. Is it possible that no one from that caravan could be located in all those years. We know that Yaakov does not search for his son as he thinks Yosef is dead, but Yosef has no way of knowing this, right? Think back for a second. How did Yosef end up where he is today? Because Yaakov sent him to his brothers. So for all Yosef knew, his father had everything to do with this. Let's read a little further. Yosef's wonder at his father's silence is joined by a terrible sense of anxiety which grows stronger over the years. As seasons and years pass by and no one comes, Yosef's anguish centers on his father. The voice inside asking, "Where is my father?" is joined by another harsh voice. "Why did my father send me to my brothers that day?" He concludes that his brothers must have succeeded in convincing Yaakov, and he had been disowned. Years later, when Yosef rides in the viceroy's chariot, when he shaves his beard and stands before Paro, it is clear to him that God must have decreed that his life would be lived separately from his family's. He gives expression to this feeling in the name he gives his eldest son, born of an Egyptian wife. He called him Menashe because God has made me forget all my labor in my father's house, to forget his father's house. Yosef's entire world is built on the misconception that his father has renounced him, while Yaakov's world is destroyed by the misconception that Yosef is dead. So there's a lot more to talk about over here, but to summarize, Rav Yoel Ben Nun basically has the perspective that Yosef never wrote home, that Yosef stepped into a new light because of the fact that he thought that that his father might have played a major part in how he ended up here. In other words, Yosef felt a certain sense of betrayal. He had no way of knowing for sure that Yaakov was not the reason that he ended up here, that Yaakov was not the one who told the brothers to sell him or try to kill him, and therefore, as a result, he felt betrayed and he wanted to go down a new path. It's interesting to note, however, that despite that, Yosef does not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? It's certainly understandable why anyone would have totally rejected the family that came, that someone would not only reject the family, but also reject the teachings and the traditions of that family. But Yosef does still keep the religion. Yosef keeps a connection to Judaism, whatever that means at this point. Yosef keeps a connection with God at this point. And it's clear that in some way, one might say that he detached the two. He said, there's my family, there's my father who seems to have thrown me out and tried to kill me, but then there's God. And God has been here with me the whole time. And not only now is God here with me the whole time, but he wants me to have a new father. Who's his new father? Maybe that new father, quote-unquote, is Paro. And so therefore, we can understand Yosef's very difficult emotional state at this point as he grapples with the fact that he's no longer part of the Abrahamic family, but he's come into this new Egyptian family, but still very deeply connected to God and all thinking at the end of the day that this is God's will with an incredible ability to do so after all the torment that he has experienced. But with that, we'll stop right here. We have a lot more to talk about, of course, in Yosef's life. What I was trying to say at the beginning, which it just wasn't coming out properly, but what I was trying to say at the beginning is that it looks like next week might be our last week before Pesach because, I don't feel like going through it all now, but I'll explain it offline at some point. But it looks like next week might be the last one, so we'll get as far as we get next week, and we'll have to pick up here after Pesach. But anyways, I'll stop worrying with all the details. I wish everyone a beautiful night and a Shavua Tov. And stay warm. Shavua Tov.